Chapter 1. My honored father and his forefathers were for many years residents in the town of Wareham, Plymouth County, state of Massachusetts. My mother was the daughter of Mr. Barnabas Nye of the town of Sandwich, Barnstable County, both towns but a few hours' ride from the noted landing place of the Pilgrim Fathers. My father was a volunteer in the Revolutionary War and continued in the service of his country during its 7 years' struggle. When General Lafayette revisited the United States in 1825, among the many that were pressing to shake hands with him at his reception rooms in the city of Boston was my father. As he approached, the general recognized him and grasped his hand, saying, "How do you do, my old friend, Captain Bates? Do you remember him?" was asked. His answer was something like the following: "Certainly, he was under my immediate command in the American Army." After the war, my father married and settled in Rochester, an adjoining town in Plymouth County, where I was born July 8, 1792. In the early part of 1793, we moved to New Bedford, some 7 miles distant, where my father entered into commercial business. During the war with England in 1812, the town of New Bedford was divided, and the eastern part was called Fairhaven. This has ever been my place of residence until I moved my family to Michigan in May 1858. In my schoolboy days, my most ardent desire was to become a sailor. I used to think how gratified I should be if I could only get on board a ship that was going on a voyage of discovery round the world. I wanted to see how it looked on the opposite side. Whenever I thought of asking my father's consent to let me go to sea, my courage failed me for fear he would say no. When I would endeavor to unburden my mind to my mother, she would try to dissuade me and recommend some other occupation, till at last I was permitted to go a short trip with my uncle to Boston to cure me, but this had the opposite effect. They then complied with my wishes. A new ship called the Fanny of New Bedford, Elias Terry, commander, was about to sail for Europe, and he agreed with my father to take me on the voyage as cabin boy. In June 1807, we sailed from New Bedford to take our cargo on board at New York City for London, England. On our passage to New York City, we sailed by the way of Long Island Sound. In this route, several miles from the city, is a very narrow and dangerous passage, bounded with rocks on the right and a rock-bound shore on the left, called Hurlgate. What makes it so dangerous is the great rush of water that passes through this narrow channel. As the tide ebbs and flows each way, it rushes with such impetuosity that few dare venture to sail through against it without a strong, steady wind in their favor. For want of watchfulness and care, many vessels have been whirled from their course by this rushing foam and hurled against the rocks, wrecked and lost in a few moments of time. Sailors call it Hellgate. As our gallant ship was bringing us in sight of this dreadful place, the pilot took the helm and requested the captain to call all hands on deck. He then stationed us in various parts of the ship, for the purpose of managing the sails in case of an emergency, according to his judgment. He then requested us to remain silent while passing this dangerous gateway, that we might the better understand his orders. In this way, every man and boy at their post, with their eyes silently fixed on the pilot waiting his orders, our good ship winged her way through the hurling foam and passed on safely to her anchorage before the city. The experienced and thorough knowledge of our pilot in guiding our gallant ship safely through that dangerous gateway with the stillness and breathless attention of her crew were stamped deeply in my mind. Promptness and exertion in perilous times on the ocean has, with the blessing of God, saved thousands of souls from a watery grave. Our good ship was deeply laden with choice wheat in bulk, even into her hatchways. It was feared that she would sink under her heavy burden. On the eve of our departure, Mr. S. Eldridge, then our chief mate, was coming on board the ship in the dark night with a lighted lantern in his hand when he fell from the plank into the river between the ship and the wharf, where the tide was running from 3 to 5 miles an hour. Mr. Adams threw a coil of rope under the wharf at a venture. Fortunately, he caught it, and after some struggle, he was hauled up on the ship's deck. When he began to breathe freely, he lamented the loss of the new lantern. Said Mr. A., "Why, you've got it in your hand. If it had been a cannonball, it would most likely have carried him to the bottom, for drowning persons hold on with a deadly grasp to whatever is in their hands." We had a pleasant run across the Atlantic Ocean. In our passage up the British Channel between France and England, we discovered a number of kegs floating on the top of the sea. The main topsail was laid to mast, and a boat lowered with a crew, which soon returned to the ship deeply laden with gin and brandy. The duties on such articles are so high from France to England that smugglers can afford to lose a whole cargo sometimes and yet make their business profitable. But if they are caught by their revenue cutters or warships while thus defrauding their government in her revenue laws, the penalty about ruins them for life. They sling and fasten them with ropes and buoys, so that by diligently hunting for them, they find them again after their pursuers are out of sight. On our safe arrival in the London dock, the English officers who came to inspect our cargo on opening the hatches expressed their surprise to see the clean and dry wheat up into the hatchway as fresh as when we left New York. When we hauled out of the dock into the River Thames and commenced filling our water casks for our homeward voyage with the river water that was passing us, finding its way to the great ocean, I thought, how could a person drink such filthy water? Streaks of green, yellow, and red muddy water, mixed up with the filth of thousands of shipping, and scum and filth of a great portion of the city of London. After a few days it becomes settled and clear, unless it is stirred up from the bottom of the water casks. Some 4 years after this, being then an impressed seaman in the British service attached to the Rodney, 74-gun ship in the Mediterranean Sea, we were emptying out all our old stock of fresh water. The ground tier was full of the same river water from the Thames, only a little further down from London, and had been bunged up tight for about 2 years. On starting the bunge and applying our lighted candle, it would blaze up a foot high, like the burning of strong brandy. Before stirring it up from the bottom, some of the clear was exhibited among the officers in glass tumblers, and pronounced to be the purest and best of water, only about 2 years from London. I admit that it looked clear and tasted good, but from my former knowledge of its origin, I confess I had a little rather quench my thirst from some of the pure springs from the Green Mountains of Vermont, or Granite Hills in New Hampshire. Among our passengers to New York was a Mr. Lloyd, chief mate of a Philadelphia ship that was detained in London. He, in a very serious manner, related a very singular incident that occurred some few years previous while he was a sailor from Philadelphia. He said that he never had dared to tell his mother or sisters of it. I will try to relate it in his own words. He said, "I was lodging away from my home one night in another part of the city, when the house was beset by the police. For fear of being identified with those that were disturbing the peace, I fled from my bed into the street with nothing but my nightdress on, and finally secreted myself in the marketplace, while a friend that was with me went back to obtain my clothes. About midnight, a gang of men passing through the marketplace discovered me, and after a few inquiries of who I was, they said, 'Drive this fellow on before us.' My pleading was in vain. They continued to keep me before them until we entered the cemetery, about 2 miles out of the city. We here came to a large flat stone with an iron hook in it. They placed a stout rope in the hook, which they brought with them, with which they swayed the stone up. This was opening a family vault, where a Jewish lady of distinction had been deposited that day. The jewelry upon her person was what they were after. The exciting question now was, who among them would go down into the vault and get the jewels? Said one, Well, here is the fellow. I begged and entreated them for the Lord's sake not to require me to commit such a dreadful deed. My entreaties were disregarded. They crowded me down into the vault, ordering me to go and strip off her jewels. I tried and then returned to the open place and stated that her fingers were so swollen that I could not get her rings off. Well, here's a knife, said one. Take it and cut her fingers off. I began to plead again, but they gave me to understand there was no alternative. I must either do it or stay where I was. Almost dead with fear, I laid hold of her hands and cut her fingers off, and when I came to the open place, they bid me hand them up. As soon as they got hold of them, they dashed down the slab and ran away. I felt overwhelmed at my hopeless condition, doomed to die a most horrible death, in fearing every moment that the mangled corpse would lay hold of me. I listened to the rumbling sound of these robbers until all was silent as death. The stone over me I could not move. After a little I heard a distant rumbling of the ground, which continued to increase until I heard strange voices over the vault. I soon learned that this was another gang, most likely unbeknown to the first, and they were placing their rope to swing up the same stone slab. I at once decided what to do to save myself. As the slab came up, I leaped out of the vault in my white nightdress or shirt. Horror-stricken, they all fled back toward the city, running with such speed that it was difficult for me to keep up behind them, and yet I feared if they should stop, I should be discovered and taken. Before reaching the city, I had drawn up some nearer the two hinder ones, when one of them cried out to his companion, "Patrick! Patrick! The old woman is close to our heels!" Onward they raced through the market and fled away from me, for I stopped here to hide myself. After a while, my friend, having obtained my clothes, found me, and I returned home. Before sailing on our voyage, a good-looking man about 20 years of age came on board, stating that he had come from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to get a passage to London. He stated that he had no means nor way to pay his passage. He also stated that his only object in going to London was to obtain a certain book, the title I have forgotten, which could not be obtained at any other place. He finally shipped for a green or new hand before the mast. This was rather new among sailors, for a man having no desire to be a sailor, to be willing to endure the hardships of a 7 months' voyage, with no other object but to get one book, and no certainty about that. But on our arrival in London, the captain advanced him some money, and before night he returned from the city rejoicing that he had found the book. I have often regretted that our acquaintance ended with that voyage, for I have often thought if his life was spared, he was destined to occupy some important position among men. On recovering from my seasickness, I commenced my sea journal to keep the run of the ship and the daily occurrences of the voyage. This and other journals, which I afterward endeavored to keep, would have been of much value to me when I commenced this work, but they were all used up or destroyed after my last voyage. One circumstance occurred on our homeward voyage some 18 days after departing from Land's End of England, which I will here relate. In the morning, Sunday, a large shark was following us. A large piece of meat was fastened to a rope and thrown over the stern to tempt him to come up a little nearer, that we might fasten to him with a barbed iron made for such purposes, but no inducement of ours seemed to affect him. He maintained his position where he could grasp whatever fell from either side of the ship. On such occasions, the old stories about sharks are revived, how they swallow sailors alive, and at other times bite them in two and swallow them at two mouthfuls. They hear so much about them that they attribute more to their sagacity than really belongs to them. It is said that sharks have followed vessels on the ocean for many days when there were any sick on board, that they may satiate their voracious appetites on the dead bodies that are cast into the sea. Sailors are generally brave and fearless men. They dare meet their fellows in almost any conflict and brave the raging storms of the sea. But the idea of being swallowed alive, or even when dead by these voracious creatures, often causes their stout hearts to tremble. Still, they are often credulous and superstitious. Toward the evening of the day referred to, when we had ceased our fruitless labors to draw the shark away from his determined position astern of the ship, I ascended to the main top-gallant masthead to ascertain if there was any vessel in sight or anything to be seen but sky and water. On my way down, having reached about 50 feet from the deck and 60 from the water, I missed reaching the place which I designed grasping with my hand and fell backward, striking a rope in my fall, which prevented my being dashed upon the deck, but whirled me into the sea. As I came up on the top of the waves, struggling and panting for breath, I saw at a glance that the ship, my only hope, was passing onward beyond my reach. With the encumbrance of my thick, heavy clothing, I exerted all my strength to follow. I saw that the captain, officers, and crew had rushed toward the ship's stern. The first officer hurled a coil of rope with all his strength, the end of which I caught with my hand. He cried out, "Hold on!" I did so until they hauled me through the sea to the ship and set my feet upon the deck. To the question if I was hurt, I answered no. Said another, "Where is the shark?" I began to tremble, even as they had done, while they were in anxious suspense, fearing he would grasp me every moment. The thought of the shark had never entered my mind while I was in the water. I then crossed over to the other side of the ship, and behold, he was quietly gliding along his way with us, not far from the side of the vessel, seemingly unconscious of our gaze. And we did not disturb him in any way, for the sailors and passengers were all so glad that the cabin boy was rescued, not only from a watery grave, but from his ferocious jaws, that they had no disposition to trouble him. He was soon missing, and we saw him no more. But the wonder to all was how he came to change his position to a place where he could neither see nor hear what was transpiring on the other side and stern of the ship. The following item from a public newspaper illustrates the veracity of these creatures. Headlines: Desperate Encounter with a Shark. Southhold, L.I., September 9, 1865. To the editor of the Herald. A few days since, the schooner Catherine Wilcox of Lubbock, Maine, George McFadden, master, being bound from New York to Eastport of Lubbock, fell in when opposite this place, with what is termed a dead calm. The opportunity seeming propitious, the captain and a young man named Peter Johnson, who was formerly a member of the 1st Maine Heavy Artillery, and who was wounded in the neck at Spotsylvania, Virginia, determined to enjoy a saltwater bath. Jumping into the water, it was not many minutes when, as young Johnson says, he saw something all white, and in an instant he was carried under the surface to a depth of 20 feet. He now discovered that he was in the jaws of one of those voracious man-eater sharks. Struggling with all his strength, Johnson managed to break away and reach the surface again, but the shark was soon after him and continued to bite him in various parts of the body. When the young man bethought him of the sailor trick of putting his fingers in the shark's eyes, which he did, and to his no small gratification soon saw the frenzied monster fleeing from him. Johnson now swam to the vessel, and being taken on board, was found to have been fearfully torn about the abdomen, its lower section entirely off, both thighs and shoulder being terribly lacerated. There being no wind to get anywhere, the crew took him in the yawl and rowed him 8 miles to the village of Greenport, where his wounds were sewed up and dressed by Doctors Kendall, Bryant, and Skinner, and the young man made as comfortable under the circumstances as possible. He's growing worse hourly, and there is not much chance for his recovery. The Sound is now full of these rapacious monsters, and if some of our New York sportsmen are fond of game worthy of their steel, this is the month to attack them. They are caught and landed with perfect safety by our villagers almost every day.